from WVUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to kids, not getting enough sleep is not just about being crabby or zoned out the next day. New research is illuminating the many potential consequences of cheating on sleep, from diminished memory and school performance to diminished brain development and maybe obesity. But it's so easy to stay up these days. Too much time at the TV and computer, all that homework and late team practices are part of the problem. Parents have a role here too. This hour, On Point, a wake-up call on children and sleep. You can join the conversation, how did a generation of Americans that were put to bed early grow up to be parents of kids who stay up so late? What's keeping the kids up to all hours at your house? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is writer, novelist, blogger, and social documentarian Poe Bronson. He wrote the recent New York Magazine cover story, Snooze or Lose. His book, What Should I Do With My Life, was number one New York Times bestseller. Poe Bronson, thanks very much for being with us.
Always fun to be on your show, Tom.
And with us from Providence, Rhode Island, is Dr. Judith Owens, a leading expert on pediatric sleep and director of the Pediatric Sleep Disorders Clinic at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at Brown University and co-author of Take Charge of Your Child's Sleep, the all-in-one resource for solving sleep problems in kids and teens. Judith Owens, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Poe, first to you. You went out and looked at kids and sleep. You've got a couple of your own. What did you find out there?
First, as you mentioned, there's this lost hour, this hour that's disappeared from slumber and turned over to what we think of as productive uses, activities, homework, time between parents and kids. And we've made a calculation that we're getting more out of being awake than out of being asleep. And sleep scientists, who normally over the tradition of the last 100 years has been to deprive people of tons of sleep to see what's happening, have kind of had a new movement over the last 10 years to try to look at what's the impact of this single hour of sleep.
Now, you're not talking a metaphorical lost hour, Poe. You're literally talking American kids sleeping an hour less than they did 20 or 30 years ago.
And this is happening around the world. But yes, literally an hour from high schoolers down through elementary schools, even kindergartners appear to be getting a half hour sleep than they did 30 years ago.
And the consequences of that, how are they beginning to be lined out in new research?
The most striking, it's not that we're surprised that sleep matters. It's how much it matters. And so we're seeing these cognitive academic consequences first and foremost, where kids who have been deprived of a single hour of sleep, who are, say, fourth graders or sixth graders, middle schoolers, are testing out two grade levels behind, that a single hour of sleep is worth 2 years of cognitive maturation and development. That in preschoolers who get plenty of sleep, just staying up 1 hour later on the weekend and sleeping in 1 hour later too, that's costing them 7 points on a standardized test for kindergarten school admissions. And then we see these broad stroke correlations, say, in large data sets of high schoolers where A students, on average, are averaging about 15 more minutes of sleep a night than the B students, who average 15 more minutes than the C students, and so on. And it appears that one of the things that's going on when you're asleep is your brain is pre-processing all of the things that you learned in school that day, and particularly re-encoding and recapsulating memories by shifting them from short-term storage to long-term storage, using different phases of sleep to do each part of this. And if you interrupt your sleep, you don't get enough sleep, different parts of that memory processing are literally not done, and things you learn that day are lost to the wind. And Fred Danner of the University of Kentucky, he's found out that with this single lost hour, what we're missing is one of our four phases of REM sleep. And REM sleep is used by the brain to process and encode long-term storage of anything that's very emotional or very difficult for you. So the hardest stuff you learn that day, you need REM sleep that night to process. And by skipping one stage of REM sleep, a single hour, we might be really cheating all that we're learning during the day.
Poe, we're going to look at that whole range of issues. Judith Owens, Judy, I'm glad you're here to do it with us. I mean, there's just so much detail in here. As Poe says, everybody understands that sleep matters, but the amount of detail that he's pulled together in this kind of survey of research that he's done here for New York Magazine, it was head-turning. Just to begin, you're the expert here. At the different ages of childhood, if you can break it down somehow, how much sleep do children need, and how much do they appear to be getting in the United States these days?
Well, I do want to congratulate Poe on a wonderful article that really highlighted so many of these critical issues that are important for parents and educators and all of us to understand. To answer your question, you know, and I get this asked all the time, the real answer is we don't know how much kids of different ages, how much sleep they actually need. What we know is the data that we have is what parents report that children on average get, which may not necessarily be a reflection of their actual sleep. As you can imagine, it's quite difficult to do the studies in which you bring children into a lab, measure their sleep, and then look at neurocognitive performance, emotion, behavior, etc. Having said that, with that caveat, we think that, for example, a two-year-old probably needs somewhere around 12 or 13 hours of sleep, which is going to involve some portion of daytime sleep, i.e. a nap.
Right.
School-age children, somewhere between 10 and 11 hours of sleep. I think the big surprise is that primary school, 6 to 10,
okay.
11-year-olds. The big surprise, and this is really reflects the work of my colleague at Brown, Dr. Mary Karskadden, adolescents don't need significantly less sleep than their middle school or even primary school counterparts.
Though they sure think they do and will tell you so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But in actuality, in order to not make any mistakes, for example, on a battery of neurocognitive tests, high school student needs between 9 and 9 1/4 hours of sleep a night. And we know that the average 12th grader probably gets less than 7.
Wow, that's a big gap. Poe lines out a lot of consequences from this, some of which I had never really thought about or imagined. I wish you'd begin to walk us through those. If at different ages of childhood, if sleep is lagging by a significant margin, you know, what can it, what does it mean beyond just a little bleary-eyed, you know, difficulty in focusing the next day?
Well, you know, I think the most obvious and consistent consequence in studies is that on mood. An increase in negative mood, a decrease in positive mood, and probably more importantly, an increase in mood lability and sort of an inability to cope with stress and frustration and kind of the everyday events of life. We also know that restricted sleep causes problems with behavior, and many studies now have documented that children who receive inadequate sleep or whose sleep is disrupted or fragmented in some way are more likely to be hyperactive. They're more likely to be impulsive. They're more likely to be oppositional. The third issue is that of cognitive performance. In particular, we know that sleep restriction affects a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. And that is a part of the brain that controls what we call executive functions, kind of higher level order functions, the ability to organize your thoughts, all these kinds of skills that are critical in academic success. And so those kids who aren't getting adequate or good quality sleep are much less likely to be attentive and focused and to be able to use those kinds of executive functions that are so important in their success in school.
And Poe Bronson, you're finding from some academics who have studied this concern that the consequences may be more than just the next day, that they may even be lifelong, theorizing about lack of sleep in formative years causing permanent changes in a child's brain structure. You quote Dr. Paul Surratt at the University of Virginia saying sleep disorders can impair children's IQs as much as lead exposure.
Yeah, this is this a new aspect of the sleep research, which is looking at permanent consequences, meaning you can't just sleep off the problems like you do a hangover, that children's brains are developing. A lot of that brain construction literally occurs while the child is asleep. Interrupting that repeatedly, inconsistent bedtimes, is going to lead to shoddy construction that can have permanent consequences. So just this is not as convincing as all the other science, I would say, but there's some fascinating and scary little teases of it where they're looking at, say, children who are 4 or 5 or 6 and looking at their emotional problems and their sleep connections, but then looking at them 6 years later, and they see that those correlations are even stronger 6 years later, causing emotional dysregulation down the road. And it's important to imagine with your child's brain that it is a work in progress. And it's a work in progress, as Judy is saying, right up until they're about 21.
They
might be 6 feet tall, and they might look already like grown-ups physically, but their brains are not done building. And to interrupt that process can possibly cause very long-term consequences.
Poe Bronson in San Francisco, Dr. Judith Owens with us from Providence, Rhode Island, and Brown University today. Please stand by. Listeners, we're talking about new insights on children and sleep and the price kids actually pay when they don't get enough. You can join the conversation. Are the kids in bed at a decent hour in your house these days? Do you remember what time your parents tucked you in? Are your kids up an hour later, 2 hours, 3 hours? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American children shy on sleep and new research on what that means for their minds and lives. Poe Bronson is with us, writer, novelist, blogger. He's got a big piece in New York Magazine recently headlined Snooze or Lose, looking at what goes on when American kids have less sleep over an extended period, maybe extended consequences. Dr. Judith Owens is with us from Brown University. She joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. You can join us as well. Do you remember what time your parents tucked you in? And are your kids getting up an hour or getting to bed an hour later, 2 hours, 3 hours? Can you see the consequences? And what pushes bedtime back in your house? Homework, TV, Facebook, the PlayStation, Xbox, Nintendo, Wii? Maybe it's this. Are you working late, then keeping your kids up just to have the time with them? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's talk to Justin, calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What do you know?
Well, I'm actually a college student, and how it actually affects myself. I'm a really big PC gamer. I play the computer a lot, and how much it affects, actually, you just get sucked right in. That there are actually times where I'm going to go to bed at 10 tonight, and then you look at the clock, and it's already midnight. It's like, wow, I have to get up in 6 hours to go to class. I have an hour commute to class that I have to go to. And in fact, I'm an elementary education major.
Right.
And I actually see the students, how it affects them, because how they talk about, you know, they want to go home and play Xbox, and it has an enormous, enormous effect. And so, I actually, in my opinion, I think my grades have been slipping a little bit because of the gaming that I have been doing.
And you're in college with those sleep hours going right down the video game hole. Can you look back? I mean, maybe you're this generation, Justin. Can you look back on your high school years and see how that began, maybe even earlier? Do you think you slept less than you might have, should have during that time?
Yes, I have. In high school, I could actually see I would go to bed later and later and later, and to the point where actually last summer, I would get up Friday morning and I wouldn't go to bed until Saturday night. I was pulling like 36 hours awake, like over the summer, because it's just unbelievable how you just get sucked in. It's almost like an addiction. It is an addiction, and just the effect. Like in the mornings, you know, I wake up, I'm tired. Now I find myself I have to get a cup of coffee because I'm just like dragging through it.
Right.
But
addicted to being awake, and maybe video games helping you do that. Justin, thanks very much for that. Poe Bronson, you write that human beings are the only creature that fight the urge to sleep. In fact, we even may have the message in our society these days that sleep is for wusses, in your phrase. Justin, can't stay off the video game, and his sleep goes down that hole.
One of the other factors is the brightness of the video screen. If he's probably playing that off his television, mm-hmm. The lumens emitted by a television is not really that. We wouldn't think of it as that bright. It's about as bright as a light bulb, but you're looking right at it, so it's like looking right at a light bulb. And that is enough to offset your circadian rhythm, possibly disrupting the melatonin secretion and the lowering of body temperature that's necessary. The biological mechanisms of it we're not super clear on, but we do know that staring at a bright screen, like a TV screen, playing video games, can keep you up an extra 2 hours later. So he never feels tired. And this is the problem, especially with, say, teenagers and college students, is they'll say, I don't feel tired. And they think you're not allowed to go to sleep until you feel tired. And so they end up never going to bed. Instead, if you just went to bed because you know it's time to go to bed, you'd fall asleep just fine.
Let's take a call from Burlington, Vermont. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. I find this really interesting subject. I'm just curious if this is correlational research. It sounds like folks are drawing causal relationships, and I'm wondering if they could speak to that. It seems to me that there could be a lot of other factors in the family life of a child that doesn't go to bed on time that could be contributing to the outcomes that they're discussing.
That's interesting. Judy Owens, what do you say? Is it just happenstantial that those that sleep less end up with the problems we've been discussing? Could it be part of a package?
I think that's an excellent point. And indeed, some of these larger scale epidemiological survey studies are correlational in nature and do not imply cause and effect. However, there have been enough experimental studies done. Poe quoted my colleague, Dr. Avi Sadeh, who did a terrific study in which basically a group of elementary school age kids had their sleep restricted at home, experimentally manipulated their sleep,
okay,
and found that decreasing sleep by 30 minutes on average resulted in significant impairment on neurocognitive tests. So there are an increasing number of studies which have really demonstrated that there is a cause and effect relationship to this.
What about family attitudes, parental attitudes? Judy, our caller Justin said he's stuck on video games, and those keep him up. But I recall in childhood, and this is a long time ago now, but parents who would put me and my siblings in bed, at a really early hour, way into primary school. It was very common in the summer for it to be fully light outside. Even if we weren't ready to go to sleep, we were expected to go in the bedroom, be in the bed, and there was a kind of a time of daydreaming and contemplation before sleep might actually come, but they were quite firm on that. What's pushing American families to let that hour go later and later, Judy?
Well, I think you mentioned many of the huge number of competing priorities that there are in our 24/7 super caffeinated society these days. You know, we did a study a couple of years ago in which we interviewed a group of inner city middle school students to try to get a sense of kids' attitudes and beliefs about sleep. And one of the most surprising things about that study was the kids actually said that they wanted their parents to tell them to go to sleep. They wanted their parents to help them manage their time mm-hmm. in the evening and to supervise this bedtime hour, because I think they realized they didn't have the internal self-control to turn off that TV, to stop the instant messaging. And so I think there is a critical period, developmental period, in which parents really relinquish control or supervision over bedtime in the middle school years, and perhaps they really shouldn't do that. I think the other piece is that this starts from a very early age, and it's a reflection of really our whole society's understanding and beliefs about sleep. You know, we spend a lot of time teaching kids about using seatbelts and wearing sunscreen and not smoking, but we don't teach them anything in school and health education about what they spend a third of their life doing.
Poe, what did you hear from parents about why they're not keeping more traditional sleep hours in their homes, in their families?
Certainly, one factor does seem to be that parents are often both working and working late. And so I heard many times, I don't get home till 7, and I want my kid to know me, and I want to have my role as a parent, and so they don't get in bed till 9. And going back to my memory, Tom, just like yours, I remember being put in bed at 7 o'clock
yeah.
and waiting till the year. I can't remember what it was, but well into almost to middle school, I could stay up till 7:30, and then I could watch Happy Days, which was on 8.
Right.
It was such a big deal to be able to stay up a little bit later. And, the hours are short. The other thing, Tom, that's important is that we've lost an hour, too, as grown-ups, at least an hour, potentially up to 2 hours. In some studies, they're seeing this. So we've cheated our sleep, and we think, and I'm okay. I'm okay. I've cheated my hour of sleep, and I'm doing all right. And so we imagine the kids are doing all right, too. But they don't report so. And because they are kids, and they're different than a grown-up brain. And it's a fallacy to put the consequences of a lost hour of adult sleep and project that onto as imagining that's a fair metric for what the lost hour means to kids.
I mean, it also leaves me imagining that maybe we all just shift our sense of the kind of alertness and bounce that we should expect in people. If the adults are groggier from too little sleep as well. Let's get Carrie on the air from Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I love sleep myself, and I kind of use that as the format for my 20-month-old twins. I like to joke around with my friends who are parents and say I'm the sleep Nazi because I do not like my children to be deprived. I have to say that I have a friend who has twins that are 2.5, and they are the model children. They're healthy, they're happy, they have phenomenal vocabularies, and they get great sleeps. So that friend has really inspired me, since my children were born. But I feel like this issue needs more exposure. For example, I saw my pediatrician in May, great pediatrician. She's been around for like 30 years. She's really well connected in the Boston area.
Yeah.
And she told me when my kids are 15 months, okay, bring them down to one nap. And I didn't tell her I disagreed, but I didn't do that. And I waited until about a month ago. When I felt they were ready. But I like what one of your experts said, because my little amateur theory is there might be a correlation between daycare versus people who stay home. I mean, people have to do daycare, but it seems like I know a lot of children in daycare who happen to be sleep deprived.
And it looks like, something like a norm to you? Or do you see a lot of sleep depth in your social circle, in your kids' environment?
In my social circle, I seem to see more sleep deprivation with kids who are in daycare because of that, parental guilt, or you get home late, and so the kids are up till late hours, whereas the parents I know who stay home, it seems to be that their kids might be getting a little bit more sleep.
Yeah, Carrie, thanks for that call. Let's talk to someone at the head of a school system where they've taken this on board, not in daycare, but in the actual school. Joining us from Edina, Minnesota, is Rick Dressen, superintendent of the Edina Public Schools, former superintendent in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a suburb of Minneapolis. In 1996-97 school year, Edina became the first district in the nation to change high school start time based on research on adolescent sleep patterns. They started they shifted from a 7:25 school start to 8:30. Superintendent Dressen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You have almost a decade of experience with this now. Other cities and towns have done it. Wilton, Connecticut, Lexington, Kentucky. What have you found? Has giving kids almost another hour potentially in bed, asleep, affected the performance of your students?
Well, it has. I mean, we have done some research back in the turn of the century. We actually worked with the University of Minnesota research to were able to demonstrate a modest performance improvement on norm reference tests with our students because of the late start. But I think more importantly, we see continual in our student surveys and our parent surveys the satisfaction of the late start. And so we think it's truly a benefit. I've got a son who's a senior, and I moved here last year. So just as a parent, I'm seeing the impact of having my son get an extra hour of sleep every day from where he was at his previous school and the impact that has on not just from an administrative standpoint, but truly from a parent standpoint, the real benefit of making sure he is ready for the day with that extra sleep.
Do you feel a difference in mood in the school? You moved from Alexandria to Edina, so
right.
can you tell?
Minnesota.
Oh, excuse me, Minnesota. Yeah. But does it feel like everybody's wide awake and chipper here?
Yeah, they're ready for the day. We find students more engaged in after-school activities because they, we're an active school. We have 85% of our students involved in activities beyond the regular school day. We're a high-performing school district. I mean, we rank in the top 100 by Newsweek, and so we there's high expectations here by our community, and yet I think it does make a difference just in performance, in attitude, in the culture of the school with that extra sleep.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Judy Owens, what do you say to the Edina experiment, and more than an experiment now? They've got nearly really a decade with it, but not that many other American schools have picked this up. What do you think of the idea of starting later to give kids a chance to sleep more?
Well, I congratulate the Edina School District for having the wisdom to do this, really based on the science that teenagers typically, at around the time of puberty, develop what we call a phase delay, which means that their circadian rhythm shifts so that they can't fall asleep as early as they did when they were younger. So there is a real biological basis to this. And of course, at exactly the time that that happens, school start times often shift to an earlier period. One of the big arguments against this that was put forth was, if you start schools an hour later, they'll just stay up an extra hour,
yeah,
and they really won't get any more sleep. And what the Edina experiment has shown is that that is not the case, that the kids will go to bed at the same time, but they are allowed to sleep in that much later, and that really has made a tremendous difference in all those parameters that were just mentioned.
Paul Bronson, do you see other schools and school districts around the country coming to grips with this and maybe considering the kind of move that Rick Dressen's Edina has made?
A small handful have been willing to trust the science, which is strange. Many school districts, look at, say, Issaquah, Washington, just east of Seattle, studied this very considerably and ended up moving their start time only 15 minutes because of competing challenges and ideas. And it's fascinating to me that people could look at this science and say, it doesn't quite smell right. If you're interested in kids, it's hard for me to fathom why one wouldn't listen to this science. I do think that what comes down to is the ethos in our society that needing sleep is a sign of weakness. And it reminds me of those old football coaches who used to drag their football players out into the summer heat and think that if they drank water, that was a sign of weakness. We're interested in the performance of our kids. We're pushing more into their brains during the day. They need more time to process it during the night.
Rick Dressen, Superintendent Dressen, how has it worked out for families in Edina? I can picture some urban areas where if the kids get dropped off at 8:30, there's not enough time for parents to be at work by 9, and many have to be at work earlier than that these days. Does it work for the whole family schedule?
Well, it works. We're a high school, and the high school is a 10-12 high school. And so we have many of our students drive or have carpool arrangements, busing, and it does work. We get very high marks on that. We're also trying to address it from another front of just trying to slow the families down. So we actually have an annual Edina Unplug Night where the entire community stops, and it's just a family night. And just to demonstrate, we can make choices. We can stop and slow down as a family and not be busy all the time. And that's where I think we're on our fourth annual event, and it's just something that it's not only an annual event, we're trying to teach that into our community of the importance of just slowing us down, getting sleep, setting our priorities, and then using the research that tells us this is a good thing for young people.
Well, it sounds like it's working in Edina, and we thank you for describing it to us. Rick Dressen, Superintendent of Schools in Edina, Minnesota, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul Bronson, Dr. Judith Owens, please stand by. Listeners, we're talking about new insights on children and sleep and the price kids pay when they don't get enough. You can join the conversation. Parents, teachers, can you see the difference when kids get enough sleep, when they get too little? Has your school district thought about starting classes later in the morning to make way for a little more sleep? Have they done it? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Deep in his mother's arms. Sleep, my baby, near to me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American children shy on sleep and new research on what that means for their minds and lives. Poe Bronson is with us. He wrote for New York Magazine a big article called Snooze or Lose. Lots of new detail in there that you may not have known about what a shortage of sleep in childhood can mean, and we'll look at more of that in this hour. Dr. Judith Owens is with us from Brown University, director of the Pediatric Sleep Disorders Clinic at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Providence. You can join the conversation as well. Does sleep sound old-fashioned these days, even for kids? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Janice is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Janice. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
This is an incredibly important subject to me. I have a stepson with ADHD and two children with autism. And the implications of this research, just looking at the rising numbers of children diagnosed over, you know, the time frame of the last 10 years or so with ADD and ADHD, and listening to your panel talk about the behavior issues that are seen in these children who are missing minimal amounts of sleep. I would be curious to know if there's any research they know of that looking at correlation there. And also for children with autism like my little ones who have such incredibly difficult sleep issues, it would seem to go to the fact that we might need to look at those, trying to help those problems however we can first, because of the long-term damage that some of these new studies have pointed out.
Janice, let us pick up exactly that. Poe Bronson, I'll come first to you. This is very serious business. Janice has, you know, a child with ADHD and two with autism, so she'll listen very carefully. Exactly what is the research you're citing suggesting when it comes to this kind of potential fallout from sleep deprivation?
I want to be careful with this information, so I'll explain it in detail just a little. Dr. Ron Chervin has looked at children who were going in for tonsillectomies and tonsillectomies really can help them improve their sleep dramatically if it's been disrupting their sleep. And before they went in, he looked at how many of these kids exhibit ADHD. They appear to be exhibiting ADHD. And then after the tonsillectomies and with the improvement of sleep, 25% of those who appeared to have had ADHD, their problems went away. And if you were to extrapolate this, which is a very big if, but if you were to extrapolate this, you can see that many children who are exhibiting the symptoms of ADHD, who might be targeted by teachers as having ADHD, might really only have sleep disorders of some sort. Now, I wouldn't say orders only in the sense that to minimize, but it's actually perhaps a different thing causing it. And there's no doubt that sleep disorders are going to cause kids to be more busy and dysregulated and impulsive. It's going to look like ADHD during the day. Are they more tired? Yes. But do they actually act more hyperactive? Yes.
Judy Owens, Dr. Owens, Poe writes that a few scientists theorize that sleep problems during formative years can cause permanent changes in a child's brain structure. And ADHD comes up in that context. And our listener asks about autism as well. What do you say on this front?
Well, there was a very recent study published in Sleep that actually looked at the relationship, a predictive relationship of sleep amounts at age 2.5 and behavioral issues as well as cognitive problems at age 6. And they did find that there was a predictive relationship between short amount of sleep at age 2.5, even if that normalized at age 3.5, and later behavior problems at age 6. So there certainly is some mounting evidence to suggest that there is there are later repercussions that are significant.
But could those sleep problems at age 2.5 be because there's already some brain structure or chemistry, you know, tilting toward, let's say, autism that's interfering with sleep? Or are you suggesting that the parent who keeps their kid up while they watch The Late Show is risking that kind of lifelong problem for their kid?
Well, I think we simply don't know at this point. That's an excellent point that you make, that the sleep issues may actually be an early marker of later psychological and psychiatric disorders. For example, children with bipolar disorder, children with autism clearly have very significant sleep issues. And I think the good news for your caller is there's a tremendous amount of interest in sleep problems in children with autism spectrum disorders. And there's active research that I think will yield some very important information in the next few years. But because we don't really know what the long-term repercussions are, I think as parents we have to pay very close attention to these kinds of issues.
Janice in Nashville, thanks very much for your call. Poe, you write about how new technology is making new insights possible here, and I was particularly struck by the functional MRI scans, looking at the sort of machinery of the brain, how neurons, to quote you, lose their plasticity, becoming incapable of forming synaptic connections necessary to encode memory when there's too little sleep. Actually, a less plastic, a less flexible brain?
Exactly right. When you learn something, what's happening is two neurons are firing. Imagine two people standing next to her who jump up and do a jumping jack. And when their hands touch, that forms a synaptic connection. And the harder they do the jumping jack, the stronger the connection. And the result is, so if I say, and 40 and your brain goes 7 years ago, the two neurons are connected and they're wired there, and the memory travels along that route. And this is synaptic plasticity, the ability of the neuron to literally do that. And a very tired brain loses its plasticity, as well as during sleep, certain genes upregulate. They activate, they turn on during sleep, and they allow for greater plasticity during the night. And for these reasons, it's very hard for a tired child to encode new memories, as well as when they don't get enough sleep at night, they're not able to sufficiently process those memories.
You're right.
Perhaps also, most fascinating to me one of you was that this, during REM sleep, the very difficult memories and emotional memories are processed by different lobes of the brain.
Yeah.
The amygdala will process negative, emotionally laden negative memories, while the hippocampus will process neutral or positive ones. So Dr. Matthew Walker at the University of California, Berkeley, has now done a little test where he's seen that sleep deprivation affects the hippocampus more than amygdala. And the result is, wildly, that sleep-deprived students will be able to recall negative emotions and negative memories nearly perfectly, but are very barely able to recall positive or neutral ones. So given a simple test of,
it's amazing.
May have them not get enough sleep and give them a simple test. Here's a bunch of words and try to remember recall the words. And they can recall 81% of words like cancer, but only 41% of words like sunshine or neutral like basket. And so think about your teenager who's sleep deprived. Think about how they perceive the world and why they might be in a bad mood. And do you think that being able to not remember your happy experiences, but having very good memory recall of your negative experiences, is going to have a long-term effect of how they achieve a narrative and describe their own life? I think it has to.
Sounds persuasive to me, and really scary to think that just that missing sleep could end up shaping your whole view of the world over a long period. Let's go to Sue in Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I love your show. I'm actually a mom of 6 kids.
Wow, okay.
And oldest being 21, youngest being 8-year-old twins, and I find it definitely an uphill battle for me because I feel like I'm the only parent around that puts their kids to bed at a decent hour. I mean, I have a 10-year-old in the 5th grade. I put her to bed, 8:15, when her friends are staying up till 9:30, 10.
Ooh, that must be rough.
Oh, and that's all I hear. Mom, how come so-and-so gets
right
to stay up late? And I just say, hey, you're going to bed, makes you healthier, happier, nicer.
You'll thank me one day.
You'll thank me one day. And another point I wanted to bring out, I also substitute teach in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I just substituted kindergarten the other day, and I noticed just in talking to the children in the morning, we have like a little meeting area where we talk about our days and things. Not only do they go to bed really late, five-year-olds, they also eat horrible. They bring in terrible snacks. They're not getting their rest. They're all over the place, and I have to think it's because of the lack of sleep and what they're eating, and it just drives me crazy.
So six kids and a substitute teacher trying to hold the line, but it can feel like a losing battle some days. Hang in there with it, Sue.
Oh, I do, definitely.
Judy Owens, Sue raises another interesting issue here on sleep and food. There are new references to obesity related to sleep, which are kind of surprising. What are we learning there?
There's some fascinating research that has been done in sort of two different camps. One is correlational epidemiological studies, which have shown that there is clearly a relationship between insufficient sleep, shorter sleep amounts, and obesity in both adults and children. There's also another line of research, and this has been done primarily in adults, in which individuals are brought into the sleep lab, had their sleep restricted to 4 or 6 hours of sleep a night for a couple of nights, and then looked at various hormonal profiles, things like insulin, cortisol, growth hormone, and particularly two hormones called ghrelin and leptin, which control hunger and satiety. And what they found is that individuals who are sleep restricted in this way eat more. They eat more higher calorically dense foods, and they eat more carbohydrates.
Because they're sleep deprived, and why does that lead them to need more to feel satiated?
Because of the imbalance that results in these metabolic profiles,
wow.
Insulin, glucose, mm-hmm. ghrelin, and leptin.
Poets, it's kind of the opposite of what you might think. You know, exercise, get out there, be active. But yet here's another perspective. Without enough sleep, you're going to be predisposed toward a behavior that puts on weight.
It spins the mind to think that a key to losing weight is to do the least the
right,
least active
sleep.
Thing humanly possible.
Right.
But that's exactly what scientists are finding. And there's a sort of, Judy's describing the five hormones that are dysregulated by sleep. I consider that sort of the quantum physics of it. There's a simple Newtonian physics of it as well, which is hinted at by the experience in Edina, where children who got more sleep were actually more active, did more extracurricular activities, not less. Children who have been sleep deprived are often too tired to go out and run around or to chase their friends and to do things. And so you get a net calorie gain from over the course of the day by having gotten a decent night's sleep.
I mean,
and so there's a simpler way at it as well. And it's quite convincing. Data in an early elementary schools seems to show that for kids who get less than 8 hours sleep, they have a 300% increase in the risk of obesity versus kids who get 10 hours of sleep. Inside that window, it's a dose-response relationship. Correlational data out of Houston public schools with middle schoolers and high schoolers found that for each lost hour, there's an increase of by 80% in the risk of obesity. And keep in mind, we're in a world today where nearly half of all kids are at what they call at risk of being obese, which is a 2 clicks down the BMI score from obesity.
But a potential explanation there for part of the obesity epidemic that people talk about nationally. It's amazing. It's amazing. Let's get a call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Donna, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 14-year-old in 10th grade who has been rapidly going downhill, even though he's a stellar student, a student from, I don't know how he manages it.
Yeah.
He fluctuates periodically, and he's been rapidly going downhill since 8th grade. He has
In academic performance, do you mean, Donna, downhill?
He fluctuates in his academic
yep.
performance, but mm-hmm. he manages to struggle up and bring them mostly up to A's, but it still fluctuates.
Yeah.
The most important part is his attitude, which has been negative, which they say is indicative of teenagers. However, he has a lot to be grateful for. His best friend has been the computer, of which he's had it in his room, and we've now removed it. I think one of the problems, I agree with a lot of the points that have been made, and I'm very grateful that you're having this topic today, is the fact that the late start is good. We have that in Brookline at 8:30.
Yeah.
However, what has been removed is physical education. And And I think that's a problem. If you're not part of the heavy-duty sports after school, there's very little physical activity.
And what about the sleep piece, Donna?
The sleep piece is that he is sleep-deprived, and he's been sleep-deprived for years, and his one night or two nights that he goes to bed at 10 o'clock obviously doesn't do it. And
right. You can't make up on it. Our time is short, but let us pick that up right there. Thank you, Donna. Judy Owens, here's a parent who clearly wishes her teenage child slept more. But Poe quotes you talking about interesting interaction where parents are ambivalent about encouraging their children to sleep more. So some who think, no, they've got to stay on the stick, keep busy, do more, you know, have that perfect record, get into that perfect college. Don't slow down, child, some say.
Well, you know, all of this is going to require an incremental change in the culture, as Poe mentioned, around sleep and its value in society. It also is going to require the science that is going to convince parents that this is really important. One of the things that you know, in your caller alluded to is this issue of trying to make up for lost sleep. And we know that many teenagers sleep in until 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon on weekends. And ironically, somewhat, this actually compounds the problem
because
it screws up the circadian rhythms.
Like jet lag.
I tell my patients it's like flying from Providence to L.A. and back every weekend. You try to fall asleep on Sunday night, and it simply isn't going to happen. So I think some of the sort of intuitive responses that parents may make to try to rectify the situation may not be the best way of dealing with it.
Poe Bronson, we just got half a minute here, but I'm struck at how this issue of sleep reaches out to touch so many problems we're wrestling with in this country. You look at all the money and effort spent on so many fronts, and then you remind us it could be as simple as just getting our young population a good night's sleep.
Isn't it funny that we work so hard and pay attention, read all the science every day about kids and child development and parenting, and press putting all these things in their lives to make sure they need this and they need that. And open up
the pharmacopoeia of drugs and everything else.
And inadvertently just taken away something so simple as an hour of slumber. And there is a dimension of we want control. You know, parents, we want to be able to engineer, be the social engineer. And giving your child back to sleep means not being in control. There's no guarantee if you give your child an extra hours of sleep that their grades will improve, their obesity will be gone.
But give them the pillow.
At some point, yeah, but at some point we have to be willing to let nature take its course.
Poe Bronson, author of What Should I Do With My Life? Always great speaking with you. And Dr. Judith Owens at Brown University, thanks to both of you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.